So we are at the input-output section of the class. I did cover some disk stuff. I'm going to back up a little and recap a few of the topics I covered last time, and then we will start with scheduling, which is something I did talk about or introduced in the last lecture. So we were talking about things like input-output. The important thing is the interface. The actual devices are of various kinds, hard drives, spinning hard drives, SSDs, flash memory, cameras, network. Network is probably one of the largest volume input-output device on any machine these days. And what else? Keyboard, mice, screens, all of these are input-output devices. They're broken down into block devices and character devices, and there's an interface, which is the hardware interface to these things, and then there is the software interface to these things, which is the driver, and then we build higher stuff. So, let me write down a few things. Screen sharing. Yeah, my screen sharing button went away. No, it's here. Okay. Although people make a distinction between character devices and block devices, there's really not much of a difference. Block devices transfer data in terms of blocks, a block being anywhere from half a kilobyte to several kilobytes. In case of networking, it's like 1500 bytes. But there is a certain fixed block size of transfer. Each transfer comprises of so many blocks of, one block of information. And the character device, one byte at a time, so the block is a byte. If the block is a byte, we call it character, that's for keyboards. And it used to be teletype devices, which we don't have anymore. Sometimes printers, I'm not sure whether they're treated as block devices or character devices, but boils down to the same thing as the block size, that's the difference. Now, a device is a reasonably complicated or and this can be all kinds of different things. So the interface or the whatever it's called, I don't remember. The interface to the device is something that converts the device characteristics into something more uniform. So, so for example, in a disk, we have each disk address is a sector and a track. A sector and a track is a little too low level for a software interface to deal with, because every disk may have different numbers of sectors, different number of tracks per sector. So this is converted into a block number. And from the CPU side of things, we only see block numbers. And this block number is accessed through the status register and the data register. And the data register might point to a bunch of addresses in memory. So the status register is a two-way traffic thing. The software can send commands to the device through the status register, as well as get responses from the device, that is, I'm done, I'm busy, I'm working, there's an error condition, all that shows up in the status register. The status register can be read or written by the CPU using memory mapped I/O or using port mapped I/O. That's minor difference between the two. And the data register is the actual data that's being sent to the device or received from the device. Now, typically we treat a device that is an input-output device like disks and networks as two separate devices, one for the output, one for the input. So they look like two devices, whereas a printer is an output device only. A keyboard is an input device only. And everything is a single, is an input device or an output device. We have both together, so that's two devices really. And that's how the... So, delving a little deeper, we have hard drives and SSDs, solid state drives. And SSDs can be high-speed devices, which we use as a substitute for hard drives, or flash memory, the pen drives and things like that. Hard drives, as I described, consists of sector and track, and then there is some management of bad sectors, and there is internal management on the hard drive which hides the bad sectors and things like that. Similarly, for SSDs, it's not sector and track, it's like random access memory. So each memory has an address, and the memory cell may be 1 byte long or 4 bytes long. We really do not know, and we really do not care, because both of these devices look the same from the software angle. That is, there is electronics or drivers inside the device which converts the sector and track addresses into block addresses, and converts the memory areas into block addresses. And the status register and the data registers are identical regardless of whether you're using hard drives or SSDs. SSDs also have much more complex management inside the SSD hardware to do things like load leveling. That is, when you write to block number 0, it writes to the memory allocated to block number 0. However, when you write to block number 0 again, it will not write it to the same memory location. It will write it to some other memory location and set up a map saying block number 0 has now moved here. And then when you write block number 0 again, it'll move it there. Why? It's load leveling. We don't want too much write traffic onto a certain part, onto the same part of the SSD. This is not a problem with hard drives. You keep on writing block 0, that's no problem. In SSDs, there is a problem. Write traffic, it only does a finite amount of write traffic over its lifetime. Read traffic is not a problem. As a result, we just move the written blocks all over the place so that each block is written far less number of times than actually written by the computer software. And there are other gimmicks of remapping bad sectors. Both hard drives and SSDs do it. This is all inside the hard drive electronic driver, as well as the SSD controller. Controller is the word. Hard drive controller and the SSD controller. So none of this is visible, or we as people dealing with operating systems don't have to care about how these things are internally working. They are all treated as block devices. Networks. Again, we have a network interface which goes on to some sort of wire or wireless. How does this part work is, we'll treat it as a black box or mystery. From this part, we again have a set of status registers and data registers. one for the output, and one for the input. And packets of data, okay, instead of calling them blocks, now we call them packets. Packets are same thing as blocks. Packets of data can flow this way or that way. And of course, we do not ask the networking device to get me a packet from the network. It arrives. It arrives unannounced. When it arrives, a packet of data arrives, and the network card issues an interrupt saying, I have one packet of data in the data register. And then you've got to consume that data, and then it'll send you one more. And if you don't, then it gets overwritten and you have dropped packages. Dropped packets. Dropped packets are not a problem because networking protocols take care of that. No, we are not going to talk about networking protocols because that's a whole class by itself. And the output works the same. That is driven by the software and it's not randomly coming in. You format a packet, you put it in the data register, and you start the network adapter to send it out, pretty much like a disked device. One thing I did not talk about is the buffering. And I'm not going to spend much time on buffering. We did talk about buffering at the beginning of the class. We did talk a little bit about buffering when we were talking about producer-consumer problems. Buffering is a producer-consumer problem. Conceptually, what's going on is that let's just look at output. So we have a device that does output, and that's one by one. And we have one or more processes at the application level that generate blocks. And if we call the one-by-one thing here, we will be sending out the data in blocks one after the other that will be guarded by a critical section. So one-by-one, the output will happen. But typically, we put in a buffer here. So and a producer-consumer queue constructed out of blocks. So when a process generates a block, it puts into one free slot. And then there is another background process which moves these buffers to the one-by-one interface and sends them out. So it actually does some speed-ups at the put end, because this, as long as the buffer is free, is instantaneous. There's no blocking. I mean, the two words here. One block means to stop, and block means a chunk of data. I know, we use the same word. So as you're outputting blocks, you don't block, because there's enough space for that, and it keeps. And then since data output happens in spurts, when the spurt is over, then the background process is flushing the buffer and getting it empty and ready for the next burst of I.O. So all this is going on, and what we are trying to do now is go a little deeper and look at this interface and what does it do. And to do that, I've already covered this, it is done by a disk or network device driver. And so the device driver, if I'm only talking about output devices, we mirror it. Reading is the same as writing, it's only in reverse. So write a block is the call to the device driver from the operating system. So the operating system calls the device driver. Application programs call the operating system using a system call. The operating system code calls the device driver using a function call. And this writer block will have a mutex semaphore at the beginning so that you do one by one. I'm not doing buffering. I'm doing one by one output. And then it puts data into data register, start output, and wait for interrupt, which will be done by a P of some interrupt thing, and finally V mutex. And the interrupt handler will do a V on input, interrupt. What's going on here? Interrupts happen on an output device only when the output is completed. So once you set up the output, put your data in the data register, which points to a buffer, one block of buffer, actual buffer is somewhere else. It puts it in the buffer and then starts the device using the go bit of the status register. The device follows the instruction. In the status register, there's block number, so it knows where to send it. And then it generates an interrupt. When that interrupt happens, you're assured that there's somebody who started this process, so it's waiting on the semaphore. So you signal the semaphore, and that somebody wakes up and picks up the data. Okay, so somehow here, no, not picks up the data, it's output, so it's gone. If it's reading, then put data will not be there, it'll be get data from the data register. So that's my device driver. Of course, I have oversimplified it, but it gives you the concept of how these things work. What else did I cover last time? Track sector block read write. Polled IO I covered. I'm not going to cover that again. Interrupts and interrupt handling. So as far as now, maybe I can say, make the following statement that disks and networks they all look alike. That is it a disk? Is it a network? Doesn't matter. You read and write into it. What about addressing? The disk has block addresses. The network has IP addresses. The IP addresses are stored inside the packet, and the network controller knows how to deal with the IP address. No, it doesn't. It sends it to the network, and on the network, there's routers dealing with IP addresses. And as far as blocks on disk, the disk controller knows where the destination is, the sector and the track, and puts it there. And that's pretty much the only difference. But as far as the interface goes, there's an address, there's a data. We have to start the device and tell it to push it out. Or there's an address, there's a data, we start the device and ask it to bring it in. Same thing. And the driver does this. That's pretty much the low-level interface into devices. I'm trying to think if I've left something out. No, I didn't. Do you have any questions? Because next topic is what I started last time, which was scheduling. To do scheduling, I was trying to hand draw a disk platter and all that, but let me see if I can give you a better picture of this. Okay, this is what it looks like. So yes, it's a mechanical device, and over here, this is the head. And since this platter is spinning in some direction, this head traces a path on the device, and that is my track. And The head also moves in these two directions, so it covers tracks, and as it moves, it will go to various tracks, and we will be able to read the data on the entire disk. That's the whole point. Now, my scheduling is about reduce track movement. I'm getting a lag here. Is my audio fine or video fine? Otherwise, I won't bother. Okay, I'm going to assume you can hear me. So, what the diagrams I was drawing is when I say here and this head is here, it just means that the head is here at this point and it moves in a lateral fashion over the disk platter, and I will show that by saying the head is moving there. So, FIFO, okay, any disk head scheduling algorithm, I think I discussed this, if you have slow disk reads or writes, the head will move to wherever the next read or write is. However, if the head is currently here and we already have queued up requests that will come on these pots, and it so happened that this is the first one which we are doing, next one is here, third one is here, fourth one is here, fifth one is here, or something like that. Now, FIFO will cause it to move to 2, then to 3, then to 4, then to 5. And while this movement is going on, we might have new ones like 6, 7, 8. So as we are processing this, it's a dynamic situation, so more and more requests are coming in. I'm treating it as a very high traffic situation. It's not always the case, but when it is, we want to be able to minimize the head movement. The FIFO strategy says you just do it in the order the requests came in. So we go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's how we do it, and that is reasonably obvious that it will cause a lot of head movement because we are not managing the sequence of requests that are already there in terms of optimizing the head movement. So to minimize head movement, we can easily think of a scheme called the shortest seek time first, or SSTF. SSTF works similarly, that is, you have the head here and you have a variety of requests that have already popped up. That's in the queue, in the driver queue, that these things are the future reads or writes that we have to do. So we are here at the blue dot, and the other requests are there. This happens to be the closest. Now, it's possible that this was request 1, this was request 2, this was request 3, this was 4, that was 5. From 1, instead of going to 2, go to 4, because that's the closest. And that way you will move it small. And then from 4, in this diagram, looks like 2 is the closest, unless if 6 shows up much closer to 4, then we move to 6. And this will minimize head movement. It's no-brainer here. But do we have a bad feeling about SSTF? And the answer is, in a high-traffic situation, yes, we can already see a problem with SSTF, although it is performing, moving the head to the closest place, which is the shortest distance you can go. So we know about our good friend starvation, and starvation is not a good thing, which essentially in this case means the head gets stuck in one zone servicing all the requests here, whereas requests over here are sitting and not getting service because there's, in this fictitious scheme, we're saying we are always getting requests here, and since that is having the it's high traffic going on over here, we will keep on servicing it, we'll be fast. It may not be optimal, but it's pretty good, and that's about it. And these people just starve out. How long? Maybe forever. Actually, it's not, because the traffic dries down and then it goes over there. But still, the delays in these things are considered a starvation issue. And there is a poor performance or latency on certain things. So your read-write speeds are very uneven. Some processes have it very good and some processes do not. Can we fix starvation? Of course we can fix starvation. FCFS, first come first serve, does not have starvation. So that's the fix. No, there could be better fixes. So we have this situation. This is 0. Okay, I renumbered it. 1, 2, 3, 4. From here, we will go to 1 because short. We will then go to 3 because it's short. And direction is depicted as we have picked that we will only move in this direction. And we keep moving in this direction until we hit the end of the disk. So there are two ends. Here's an end, here's an end. Which are the two ends? One is the innermost track and one is the outermost track. And in this diagram, we don't care which is the inner track, which is the outer track. We just have a sequence of tracks and we are happily moving in only one direction. So that means we reach the end of it after some time. When the end is reached, we turn around and move the other direction. So we sweep up the requests in one direction, moving shortest seek time first, not by the order they came in, but whichever is closer, that's one. But we keep on moving in this direction, then we go back moving in the other direction. And that's all that is to it. It is also called the elevator. If you have just one elevator in a building, it goes all the way up and it comes all the way down. Why doesn't it switch around in the middle? Because that causes all kinds of trouble. Plus, elevators have a different thing. It's not a good idea to call this an elevator algorithm, though we see a resemblance to an elevator. When somebody goes in there, that human being chooses that he or she has to go up or she has to go down, which is not the case in disk head scheduling. We don't care which way the disk head is moving, the data will be getting to its destination based on where the data. Data only has a destination, it doesn't have this way or that way, which is not true for humans on an elevator. They get in at one place, get off at another. But yeah, the elevator will go. Now, starvation, this has no starvation. Because you're essentially going over the entire disk in each of the directions of travel. And this is the algorithm or its variants that are used in disk devices. There are several variants of scan. One is called C-scan. C stands for circular. And I'm not sure why you would want C-scan. Maybe it's something to do with the mechanisms in the disk. That is, you scan only in one direction. You don't go the reverse direction. You just go all the way to the end of the disk in one direction, servicing requests. And then when you reach the end of the disk in that direction, you actuate a server motor that brings the head bang back to the beginning. It does not do any requests. It goes all the way back and restarts the scanning in the same direction. And there's probably something to do with how the disks are designed and how they work that C-scan works better. But I'm not sure if it really does. It's a little counterintuitive to me. And then we have look. Look is the same thing as scan, but do not go to the end. Now notice when I was talking about scan, I said keep scanning the disk, and when you reach the last one, you still scan and move the disk head to the other end of the disk. Why? Of course that's not necessary. But scan is a theoretical algorithm which says you go up to the end of the disk and then you reverse and come back and go to the other end of the disk. Well, that's obviously a waste of time. So look says do not go to the end. Stop at last request in that direction. Obvious. And then reverse. And then you go back till the last one on this side, then you go forward till the last one on this side. So look is much more practical algorithm rather than scan or rather than scan. And since we have look, we have C look, circular look, which is the same thing as circular scan, but instead of doing end-to-end scanning and retracting, we just retract to the first one and then go back up again. And those are the four disk head scheduling algorithms that we talk about. Now, where is this? Is this in the device driver? Yes. Where in the device driver is this scanning algorithm or whatever algorithm you're doing? So the device driver, oversimplified device driver that I talked about, says write block number. And we have P mutex. And we have a few things. Then we have P interrupt. And we may have a few things, and I forgot the V mutex. And in this, if my semaphore queue, where are all the requests queuing up? It's queuing up in a FIFO queue at the semaphore. So, if you want to do scheduling, you'll have to use a special implementation of a semaphore where when you add, so what you're doing here is your add queue and delete queue for the PNV. So these have to be changed to reorder the queue. So when you're adding something into the queue, you instead of doing it add at the end, delete at the beginning, you do add at an appropriate point depending upon who else is there, and you keep the queue sorted. Keep the queue sorted in the distance order or distance and direction and all that. So the intelligence of handling the scheduling algorithm has to go in over here. And it's not a straight semaphore implementation which uses a queue, but it's a semaphore type of thing implementation which uses an ordered sequence of requests where the ordering is determined by what kind of scheduling algorithm we are using. And that's where the disk head scheduler is. Okay, a few other topics that I'm going to cover before I get to the big one, which is file systems. And if I have questions, I'll take it. Let's do some questions here. People have been very silent for the last few lectures. Anybody? No, I don't see anybody asking questions. So managing the disk happens at various different levels, at the driver level and the physical layout of the disk level, the formatting level, etc. There's several different ones. It goes up to file systems, which is also disk management at a different level. So we're not going to talk about file systems yet. So what's there to manage a disk? What is a disk? It is a set of blocks. And blocks have an address, so this is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to some large number n. And each of these blocks can be read or written in any order, and they get mapped into sector and tracks by the device controller. So now we have this huge bunch of blocks. Do we need to manage them? Yes, we need to manage them because for whatever reason we like disks to be partitioned, we like certain disks to be bootable, we like certain things to keep track of free space. Because so at the basic layout, somewhere in the beginning, most likely block zero, there is something called an MBR. And the master boot record contains, amongst other things, the partition table and the free blocks. The free blocks are somewhere else. But anyway, we have to keep track of free blocks, and we have to keep track of partitions, and we have to keep track of the boot program where the system boots. So to do that, we have a master boot record. The master boot record may span one or more blocks, but it is a standard format that is used for all machines so that the basic BIOS, which is called, understands master boot records and can boot the system properly. So the partition table, okay, introduced a new word, partition. You've heard of partitions. Partition in the general sense means, since you've got these large set of blocks on the disk, we will treat it as multiple disks. So this is block 0 to block N1, This is block 0 to block N2. This is block 0 to block N3. And this is disk 1, disk 0, disk, should be N0, N1, N2, disk 1, disk 2. So, for whatever management reasons, people like to partition a disk, and partitioning a disk creates three or more separate disks out of one disk. So the partition table consists of zero. In this case, there are three partitions. So it will say we have three partitions, that how many partitions are stored. And in the table, we have the data of start and end. So start at 0, end at 15. I'm making up numbers. Start at 16, end at 25, 26. And there could be gaps also. The gaps are just unused space. It will never be used. Now, if I do it this way, then what is the block address here, which is the fifth block in this area? It's really 15 plus 5, so that's 20. So when we are accessing fifth block of D1, there is a translator which translates it to the 20th block of the entire disk. That's the logical physical mapping. We've talked about things like logical physical mapping several times, so we've got to add the start address to get the actual block number. So this is the partition table. And one of these partitions is marked bootable. Let's say the second partition is bootable. And hence, there is a bootloader address in there. And this is the block where the loader is. Of course, every disk partition may be bootable, but there is only one primary bootable disk partition. You can change it using disk management software. And let's say this is bootable, so it will read out the bootloader address and load the code from there. And the code knows where the kernel is. Of course, where is the kernel? The kernel is a file. The file, now we're talking file system, so it really has a name of where the kernel is. And then the bootloader has to, after the bootloader loads up, it has to know something about the file system and get to that file name in some manner. And that varies a little. So whatever the magic is, I'm not very familiar with how exactly the booting works. We did talk about booting way back in the class, but there is something called the current boot partition, and it has information of how to load up an initial resident monitor, which is part of the BIOS, and then that resident monitor knows where to find the operating system and then loads the operating system. So this is the basic starting point of disk management, where the master boot record tells you where things are. So we have a boot partition, which also contains the operating system. We may have a data partition. Some people set up a swap partition, which is for demand paging. And each partition has a free block table. So for each partition, we keep yet another table somewhere which contains what blocks in this partition are free. That is used by the file system to allocate new blocks. So the free space uses a bit vector. So here we have the partition. Somewhere here is the boot code, if it's bootable. And here we have free space map. Free space map is a set of blocks where this, its bits, zero means free, one means used. What's going on here? What's going on is this is a set of bits. Each bit corresponds to a block on the partition. So this is block 0, which is really this guy there. So block 0 is not free because that contains some boot code and all that. So each bit in this bit vector is really representing a block on that partition telling you whether that block is free or not. So there'll be a lot of ones in here where they're free and zeros. Now how big is this? This free space area is n bits long, where n is the number of blocks in that partition. So if you have a million blocks in the partition, it'll be a million bits, and a million bits is a small amount of data compared to a million blocks. 1 divided by 4096 or something like that. So we have the static, we can pre-calculate what's the free bit vector sizes and put it in a set of blocks, and in the master boot record there will be the location and size of the free space vector. And that is used by the file system and, of course, has to be updated as the disk management stuff keeps reading and writing from disk. A slight diversion into RAIDs. I don't see how RAID fits in the topic line up here, but we'll talk about RAIDs. You must have heard about RAIDs. That's what the data centers use for their disks. RAID stands for redundant arrays of inexpensive disks. It's funny that they stuck the word inexpensive in there. Disks are kind of inexpensive, especially if you're running a large data center. You have lots of data to store. You have lots of disks. At some point in the past, decades ago, disks went from very expensive stuff to reasonably cheap to cheaper, and it became inexpensive at some point. When someone came up with the idea, which is really then renamed RAID 2, but there's an idea of how to use lots of redundancy in the disk storage area to gain either performance or speed or both. And then if things got reclassified and various things, so we'll start with RAID 0. RAID 0 is not for it's for efficiency, it's not for reliability. And it's also called striping. So we do bit level striping. That is striping, and I'm going to do it in concept. Let's say we have 8 disks. And this is 1 byte. Or even could be 1 bit. This is the, for a block, we split it up into bytes, and byte 0 goes here, B1 goes here, B2 goes here, and B7 goes there. So now we have 8 bytes stored. This is B8. Okay, so take a block and put the first byte in the first disk, the second byte on the second disk, etc. And then the next ones go like that. Why? Because when you read a block, you will actually get a block out of this disk. And at the same time, you can get a block out of 8 disks, and you will get total of 8 blocks of material read from the disk, and it will be in the time taken to read a block. So you have theoretically an 8 times speed up. You're getting 8 times the amount of data in one read because they're all working in parallel. And so why don't we do it bit level? You can do it bit level, you can do it that level. Why don't we just put multiple blocks on different devices? Well, then maybe you won't be reading them sequentially. And there are reasons why this turns out to be a reasonably effective way if you increase your block size to be 8 blocks long, and then you stripe them, and your read or write speed goes up dramatically, and that's rate 0. So, but if one of these disks fail, any one fails, you're corrupted. You've got data scattered all over the disk, so the reliability is reasonably poor for rate 0, but it's speed is reasonably high, not reasonably, quite a bit higher than standard disks. RAID 1 is mirroring. You use 2 disks, you can use more than 2 disks. Here's block 0, here's block 0. So you have mirrored disks. When you write to both disks. Write speed slows down? Not really, because these two disks are independent. You use 2 channels, and hence you can write one block on both disks in the same time as it takes you to write one block on one disk. But when you read, you just read one. What's the point? The point is, if one disk crashes, you immediately detect that because you'll get corrupt errors, and then you switch over to the next disk. You will have time to replace this disk with a new one and rebuild the RAID. That is, you'll have to mirror the whole thing again. So there is some downtime, but you don't lose any data. Okay. As far as I remember, what really started this RAID business is now called RAID 2. And I'll stop here. RAID 3, RAID 4, you can read it up. It's just more innovative ways of doing RAID. But RAID 2, to me at least, is the most, appealing one from a theory point of view. So you have one spindle, and you attach 9 disks to it. And this one spindle, okay, you have 9 disks. You somehow mechanically mount them on one spindle such that the disks can actually be separated also, but when you plugged in, they all work together. And you bit stripe. So one byte will be written as, there'll be one bit of each byte on each disk. So I said 9 disks, we need 8 disks. But the 8th disk, so we have the byte 0, byte 1, byte 2, up to byte 7 on 8 disks, And the ninth disc is the parity bit. Okay? The idea being that why am I calling the ninth bit parity? Ninth is an XOR of all of these. Turns out that regardless of how you do it, one can call any one of these bits the parity bit. Because it's the way XOR works, this is the XOR of everything, so this is the XOR of all the others also. It's a very commutative operation. So, idea being that if one disk fails, you can even run with one disk gone because you can reconstruct that bit because of the parity. But you can tolerate one failure. If it fails, it fails. You lost your resiliency. Now you have to run with no parity check. But if it fails and you decide to take that disk, physically remove it, plug in a brand new disk there, you will have to then rebuild the parities, but you lose no data. And this is the same thing as mirroring? No. In mirroring, you're increasing the volume. The amount, if you want to store 1 gigabyte, you're using 2 gigabytes of storage. Here, if you want to store 1 gigabyte, you're using 1 1/9 gigabytes more. So the amount of redundancy is very low. But you get the same effect as mirroring. And because of the construction on one spindle, you can just take a disk out, plop in another, and it goes. And that's the idea of RAID 2. So RAID 3, RAID 4 is the intermingling of RAID 1, RAID 2, and RAID 0. And there's a whole slew of innovative ideas between handling disks. I am not in industry. I don't know which one is used more commonly. But they're kind of nice, cute methods of handling efficiency. Now, RAID 2 is also efficient because it's doing striping, so it's faster, and it's also handling reliability. That is, any one point in time, if two disks fail at the same time, you're hosed. If one disk fails, you don't care, you just replace it. So low-level disk management, I'm pretty much done. I will spend a few minutes. We have 15 minutes, but I don't need all of 15 minutes today. I'll give you an introduction to file systems, and I'll do the implementation stuff next time. Really? Don't have any questions? So we have the disk part, which is what we've been talking about so far. Same thing applies to SSDs, similar things applies to networks, but networks we don't do file systems. Okay, network file system is different from file system. I'm not going to address network file, NFS, you know about the, what's it called? The network mapped drives. That's not what we're talking about. Anyway, so the disk drive is a bunch of blocks. Maybe there's partitions, but for now, let's just say a disk contains one partition and it's a set of blocks. However, if we use disks as sets of blocks, that is quite unusable. A disk would look like a massive file cabinet, each drawer being one block of storage, and in that one block of storage, you have the storage space of like 10 or 20 pages of information if you're using ASCII, but ASCII is one of the least used forms of disk storage. And then if you've stored a bunch of information, they will not be in subsequent files, subsequent boxes, because while you were storing things here, somebody else used the next block. So it's scattered all over. And you will need to know that my information is located at block number 100 and block number 325 and block number... It just gets... becomes a mess. So every operating system, even from days of old, uses something called a file system to organize the data that is being stored on disk. The reason being, this is long-term storage. In long-term storage, you have to have some human understandable qualities. And this human understandable qualities becomes things like file names. There is no such thing as file names on disk. There is just disk blocks. But we need to introduce the ability of naming a chunk of data something, my something, or video number 23, or whatever it is. So this thing called a file name is a very human-centric stuff. And so we, the basic block of file systems is every file, there is a concept of a file. A file is a storage unit of variable size, and it'll have properties which we'll get to. So we have lots and lots of files. Now if we have lots and lots of files, we are almost back to this thing about there's lots and lots of boxes to store things in. And they all have names. Now we have to give them all unique names. And then it's a huge thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of files. That's not very human friendly either. So we have folders or directories. Directory was the older term, folder is the newer term, popularized by Windows, but they're the same thing. So we have folders or directories. This is, both of these things are for organizing human-friendly information. And in addition to file names and directories, you need some structure. You can have flat file systems, you can have one-level directories, you can have two or multiple or acyclic graphs. So that's where it gets a little deeper into file system management and organization. But where is all this information? This information is not just in our human brains, but it has to be stored somewhere. And hence we invent the word metadata. I did not use the word metadata so far, but metadata is also there in this disk management stuff, like the free space vector. That's metadata. It's telling you, it contains some data that reflects on the data that's stored on the disk, telling you which blocks are free and which blocks are not. The master boot record is metadata. The partition table is metadata. Now we are going to add a whole slew of more metadata talking about how the naming and the directories and etc. works. So how do we do this is the question, and there are lots of completely different implementations of the file system. There's the old Unix file system, there's the Linux file system, there's NTFS, there is FAT32, there is many others that have been invented and have lost its charm, then there are journaling file systems. So there's a gamut of stuff comes under the file systems. We'll boil it down to a few concepts and overarching concepts of that's embodied in all file systems, and we'll do a case study of the Unix file system, which was considered to be one of the best ones. No, sorry. That was the simple and cute implementation, and that's uncomplicated enough to be covered in a class. Since then, file systems have become horrendously complicated. In fact, the majority of code, no, not the majority. Now the graphics system is the majority of the code in the operating system. Apart from the graphics, the file system is the largest bulk of code in the operating system. So to talk about file systems, we will start with what is a file. Oh yeah, like everybody knows what's a file. But no, there is a very specific definition of a file in the operating system. The files, each file, we're talking about one file. One file consists of an uninterpreted sequence of bytes, we understand. Let's go with the sequence of bytes. So we have a beginning and an end and a certain size, and these, so this is concept. This is not what's real on disk. You visualize the disk that it contains a lots of things, and each thing being a file, and a file is a sequence of bytes. And also I snuck in the word uninterpreted. That means there is no structure or anything imposed by the operating system as to what these bytes may contain, what they mean. The meaning is not handled by the operating system. It's handled by application processes, and they decide to store data. It's just data with no interpretation added to it. And what the operating system is entrusted to do is keep these sequences, and the sequence is important. The first byte is always this guy, the last byte is here, and all of these bytes are ordered. In each byte has a byte address, which is starting from this byte number 0 to byte number X, which is the end of the file. And the end of the file is not a special marker, as some people teach in other classes. There is no such thing as end of the file. End of the file is the last byte of the file. It is determined by the size of the file, which is fixed for each file at the point where the file was created. It can be changed. It's not fixed, but at any point in time, it's fixed. And the last byte is the end of the file byte. And the end of the file byte is also not interpreted. That is, it may contain any data, not a marker. Okay, so already we've kind of gotten into a little bit of end of file business. Let's see, there's a chat message. Seems easily corruptible. Yes, corruptible. We have to assume disks never die, because when it does, you've got to start all over again. So yes, if this thing in the middle gets corrupted, you've got a corrupted file, and you'd better have a backup, otherwise this is gone. And that's the fact of life with working with disks. They're long-term storage, they are corruptible, and in the file system, we are not going to deal with how to stop corruption. How to stop corruption is part of the disk management. There you move blocks around from bad sectors if possible, or you use RAID, or you use backups, or whatever at that level. Here we are not going to talk about corruption because, again, various levels of abstraction. When we talk about file systems, nothing gets corrupted. Is that true? No, it's not true. But operating systems live on lies. We have virtual memory, we have virtual processors, we have virtual machines, we have virtual everything, and they all work. Reality is a little different. Okay, so that's the concept of a file. And this storage structure does not exist on disk, so we have the logical physical mapping which makes this happen. Got a few more minutes? Properties of files. A file has a name, and this name is statically assigned to this file until it's changed. So somehow we have to know what file names are. And the file name is not inside the file. File has a size. These two are the most important properties. Then it has an owner. Then it has timestamps, permissions, various statistical counters, not important. Timestamps, when was it created, when was it modified, it's useful for looking up various things. Permissions, who can read it, who can write it, who enforces permissions, the operating systems does. There is more. Yeah, there'll be some location information which is hidden from the human user or even application program. That's where is it on disk? What blocks consist of it? But that's part of the metadata. And there is more. So these are the properties that a file system has to keep track of. And the rest of these properties vary from operating systems to operating systems. Like Windows enforces read-write locking on files. Unix does not. So each operating system, each file system has different properties, but the important ones, name, size, owner, timestamps, and maybe permissions, not everybody supports permissions, have to be part of the file system. And then you have directories, and the part that I'm not covering today, but will cover access methods, and system calls. Of course, that includes read, write, delete, rename. So our focus will be to handle all this, what kind of software, what kind of metadata, what kind of stuff do we have to put in an operating system to build and handle a file system. And that's what I'll cover next class. And then there is one more class left. I'll figure out what I want to cover, and then we will slowly wrap up the class. I will also in the next few classes talk about some details about the final exam, because yeah, that's coming up. We have a chat message here. That's an interesting lecture. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm kind of done here. I'll take questions if you have any. Okay, thank you for coming. Okay, recording stopped, and I can now sign out.